The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, my name is Sarah from the Talking Information Center. Today is June 22nd, 2026, and I'll be reading selections from the Diabetes Update. This popular fermented food may help flush microplastics from the body. Source, National Research Council of Science and Technology. Scientists in South Korea say a probiotic bacteria found in kimchi may help the body get rid of nanoplastics by binding to the particles inside the intestine and help removing them through waste. The World Institute of Kimchi, President He Chun Chang, a government-funded research institute under the Ministry of Science and ICT, announced the findings after studying a strain of lactic acid bacteria isolated from kimchi. Nanoplastics are extremely small plastic particles measuring less than 1 micrometer, 1/1000th of a millimeter. They form as a larger plastic materials break down over time and can enter the body through food and drinking water. Because these particles are so tiny, researchers are concerned that they may pass through the intestinal barrier and build up in organs including the kidneys and brain. Scientists are still in the early stages of finding biological ways to reduce nanoplastic accumulation in the digestive system. A research team led by Drs. Si He Lee and Tae Wu Wong at Y Kim focused on a kimchi-derived bacterium called leukognosotic mesenteroids, CBA3656. The scientists tested how effectively the strain could attach to polystyrene nanoplastics, PS-NPs. Under standard laboratory conditions, the kimchi strain achieved an absorption efficiency of 87%, nearly matching a reference stain called Lactobacillus sacchi, CBA3608, which recorded 85%. The difference became much more noticeable under conditions designed to resemble the human intestine. The absorption rate of the reference strain dropped sharply to 3%, while strain CBA3656 maintained a far stronger binding level of 57%. According to researchers, this suggests the kimchi-derived bacterium can continue attaching to nanoplastics even in environments similar to the human digestive tract. The team also tested the probiotic in germ-free mice. Male and female mice that received strain CBA3656 showed more than double the amount of nanoplastics in their feces compared with mice that did not receive the probiotic. Researchers say the findings indicate the bacterium may help remove nanoplastics from the body by binding to the particles in the intestines and promoting their exertion. The study adds to growing evidence that microbes found in fermented foods may do more than support food production and digestion. Scientists say these microorganisms could also interact with environmental pollutants inside the body. Plastic pollution is increasingly recognized not only as the environmental issue, but also as a public health concern, said Dr. Si He Lee, the lead researcher of the study. Our findings suggest that microorganisms derived from traditional fermented foods could represent a new biological approach to address these emerging challenges. We will continue to expand the scientific value of kimchi microbial resources to contribute to public health and environmental solutions. The findings were published in the journal BioSource Technology, Impact Factor 9.9, which is ranked number one in the agricultural engineering. Scientists found a smarter Mediterranean diet that slashes diabetes risk by 31%. Source, University of Navarra, Spain. A Mediterranean diet is already famous for its heart and metabolic benefits, But a major Spanish clinical trial suggests it may work even better against type 2 diabetes when paired with three realistic upgrades: eating fewer calories, moving more, and getting professional support for weight loss. The pre-DMED Plus trial found that this more structured version of the Mediterranean living reduced the risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 31%. The project is the largest nutritional trial conducted in Europe and involved the University of Navarra, along with more than 200 researchers from 22 other Spanish universities, hospitals, and research centers. The work was carried out in more than 100 primary care centers within Spain's national health system. The results, published in Annals of Internal Medicine, were based on 4,746 adults between ages 55 and 75. All had overweight or obesity and metabolic syndrome, but none had diabetes or cardiovascular disease at the start of the study. Researchers followed participants for 6 years to see whether a more intensive Mediterranean-based lifestyle could offer stronger protection against type 2 diabetes than the traditional Mediterranean diet alone. One group followed a calorie-reduced Mediterranean diet, about 600 kcal fewer per day, added moderate physical activity, brisk walking, strength and balance training, and received professional guidance. The comparison group followed a traditional Mediterranean diet without calorie restriction or exercise advice. The difference between the two approaches was striking. Participants in the intervention group were 31% less likely to develop type 2 diabetes than those in the comparison group. They also lost more weight and reduced abdominal fat more effectively. On average, the intervention group lost 3.3 kilograms and reduced waist size circumference by 3.6 centimeters. The control group lost only 0.6 kilograms and trimmed their waist size to 0.3 centimeters. In real-world terms, the researchers estimated that the program prevented about 3 cases of type 2 diabetes for every 100 participants. For a condition affecting hundreds of millions of people globally, that kind of prevention could add up quickly if applied broadly among people at elevated risk. Diabetes is the first solid clinical outcome for which we have shown, using the strongest available evidence, that the Mediterranean diet with calorie reduction, physical activity, and weight loss is a highly effective preventative tool, said Miguel Angel Martinez Gonzalez, professor of preventative medicine and public health. Changes could prevent thousands of new diagnoses every year. We hope to soon show similar evidence for other major public health challenges. Type 2 diabetes is one of the world's fastest-growing chronic diseases. The International Diabetes Federation estimates that more than 530 million people worldwide now live with diabetes. The rise has been fueled by urbanization, less healthy diets, more sedentary lifestyles, reduced physical activity, population aging, and increasing rates of overweight and obesity. Spain has about 4.7 million adults with diabetes, most of them type 2, one of the highest rates in Europe. Across Europe, more than 65 million people have diabetes. In the United States, about 38.5 million people are affected, and the country has one of the highest health care costs per patient in the world. Experts warn that the prevention is essential because type 2 diabetes raises the risk of cardiovascular, kidney, and metabolic complications. The Mediterranean diet acts synergistically to improve insulin sensitivity and reduce inflammation. With PrettyMed Plus, we demonstrate that combining calorie control and physical activity enhances these benefits, explained Miguel Ruiz Canela, professor and chair of preventative medicine and public health department at the University of Navarra's School of Medicine and the first author of the study. It is a tasty, sustainable, and culturally accepted approach that offers a practical and effective way to prevent type 2 diabetes, a global disease that is too large to extinct, avoidable. Since the PreMedi Plus diabetes findings were prepared, related research has continued to strengthen the broader picture. PreMedi Plus, body composition analysis published in the JAMA Network Open found that the energy-reduced Mediterranean diet plus physical activity helped reduce total and visceral fat while slowing age-related loss of lean muscle mass in older adults with overweight or obesity and metabolic syndrome. That matters because visceral fat and declining muscle are closely tied to cardiometabolic risk. More recent PredMidi Plus work has also explored how sedentary time may affect cardiovascular health. A study at BMC Cardiovascular Disorder reported that replacing sedentary time with physical activity was associated with favorable five-year changes in high-sensitivity troponin T, a blood marker related to heart stress, although the pattern was not consistent across all atrial fibrillation-related biomarkers. Other Mediterranean diet research continues to support the pattern's broader cardiovascular value. A 2025 review of the cardiovascular research described the Mediterranean diet as one of the best-studied dietary patterns for cardiovascular prevention, citing large randomized trials including PredMed Plus, CardioPrev, and the Lion Heart Diet Study. Analysis from the original PredMed trial also highlighted the possible importance of food quality within the diet. Participants with higher cumulative intake of extra virgin olive oil had a lower risk of broader cardiovascular outcome, while common olive oil showed weaker associations. The finding supports a less practical message for readers. The Mediterranean diet is not only about eating less or eating more plants. The type and quality of fats may matter too. Annals of Internal Medicine published the study alongside the editorial by Shannon J. Herring and Gina L. Tripicchio, nutrition and public health experts at Temple University, Philadelphia, USA. They praised the clinical importance of the intervention and its potential as a model for preventing type 2 diabetes. At the same time, they cautioned that bringing the same strategy to places outside the Mediterranean region, including the U.S., would require more than the individual willpower. Barriers such as unequal access to healthy food, urban environments that make the physical activity harder, and limited access to professional guidance could all stand in the way. They argued that public policies should help create healthier and more equitable environments. That point is especially relevant now as drugs for obesity and diabetes continue to attract major attention. PredMed Plus showed that medication is not only the path of with power. Sustained lifestyle changes, when supported properly, can still produce major health gains. The PredMed Plus project, 2013 to 2024, which involves different patients, builds on the earlier PredMed study, 2003 to 2010, that previous trial showed that a Mediterranean diet enriched with extra virgin olive oils or nuts reduced the cardiovascular disease risk by 30%. Researchers say that updated PredMed Plus strategy could be used by primary care providers as a sustainable and cost-efficient way to prevent type 2 diabetes on a broad scale. The intervention does not rely on extreme dieting. It combines familiar foods, moderate activity, gradual weight loss, and professional support. The PredMed Plus trial brought together a large network of investigators from across Spain. In order of participant numbers, participating institutions included the University of Navarra and the Navarra Health Service. Five facts and myths about protein, unpicked by experts. Source, Medical News. Protein is vital for numerous functions, including hormone regulation, the structure and repair of bodily components, digestive health, and muscle maintenance. Mir Ali, MD, bariatric surgeon and medical director of Memorial Care Surgical Weight Loss Center at Orange Coast Medical Center in Fountain Valley, California, told Medical News Today. It is essential macronutrient obtained widely from diet, and not getting enough protein can lead to serious health issues, including malnutrition and loss of muscle mass. as Michelle Rothenstein, MS, RD, CDSEC, CDN, preventative cardiology dietitian at Entirely Nourished, further explained, protein is essential to human health. It's needed to repair tissues, make hormones and enzymes, support immunity, and build and maintain muscle and bone. Adequate protein helps with muscle strength, physical performance, energy balance, recovery, satiety, healthy aging, and cardiometabolic well-being. But can you have too much protein? Do some people need more than others? And what are the best protein sources? Ali and Rothenstein have answered these and other key questions for MNT. Everyone is likely familiar with the notion that fish and meat are the top sources for protein, and there is a widely circulating idea that certain amino acids, the molecules that make up proteins, can only be obtained from meat sources. This has further led to the idea that people who follow a plant-based diet may not be getting all the protein they really need. Rothenstein, however, told us that this is inaccurate. There's a common myth that you cannot get all your essential amino acids from a plant-based diet, but that's not true, she said. Complete proteins contain all 9 essential amino acids, which are histidine, isoleucine, leucine, lysine, methionine, phenylalanine, threonine, tryptophan, and valine, the dietitian explained. She advised that animal foods like meat, poultry, eggs, dairy, and fish are typically complete proteins, meaning each contain all 9 essential amino acids in adequate amounts. Several plant-based foods, including soy, tofu, tempeh, edamame, quinoa, buckwheat, hemp seeds, and chia seeds are also complete proteins. For other plant protein sources, eating a variety of beans, lentils, whole grains, nuts, and seeds over the course of the day easily provides all the essential amino acids your body needs. Ali agreed, noting that while certain components, such as collagen, elastin, and myoglobin, are primarily available in the animal protein, alternative sources such as vegetable-based proteins are also adequate. Recommended protein intake is typically based on a healthy target weight, usually ranging from 0.75 to 1.0 grams per kilogram of body weight, Ali advised. This varies based on age, activity levels, and other factors. Once a goal is determined, apps and other resources can help track intake to ensure adequate consumption, he suggests. According to Rothenstein, the first step to ensuring your intake is adequate is knowing how much protein you need to maintain or build muscle, depending on your goals. For active adults without kidney issues, aim for at least 1 to 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day, spread across meals, she said. Include a mix of lean animal and plant proteins, or focus on a variety of plant proteins if following a plant-forward diet. People who use GLP-1, drugs like Wegovy, for weight maintenance purpose may have heard that they should up their daily protein intake. This, both Ali and Rothenstein confirmed, is correct. GLP-1 medications, Rothenstein explained, work by reducing appetite and slowing digestion, which can make it easy to unintentionally eat too little protein. If protein intake drops while losing weight, you may lose lean muscle. Prioritizing protein helps preserve muscles, support metabolism, and keeps you full even on fewer calories, she advised. It is important to maintain sufficient protein intake during any weight loss program to preserve muscle mass while burning excess fat, Ali also emphasized. A popular option for supplementing protein intakes are protein shakes or protein powder, but these have also been linked to dangers such as overeating and blood sugar spikes. According to Ali, protein shakes are a beneficial source of supplementation for those who may struggle to meet their protein requirements through whole foods alone. Rothenstein agreed, noting that shakes are especially convenient for people who lift weights or train regularly and may struggle to get enough protein from whole foods alone. However, she cautioned that that these should supplement, not replace, nutrient-dense lean proteins from whole foods. What matters most is the total protein amount and quality, she told us. Both experts warn that while protein is certainly key to maintaining good health, people should not fall into the trap of boosting their intake to a point where it becomes perilous rather than helpful. Eating protein well above your needs can have downsides, Rosenstein pointed out. It may stray kidney function in people with kidney disease, increase calcium loss in urine, and potentially contribute to vascular inflammation. Excess protein can also displace fiber-rich plant foods, and if highly processed, may raise cardiometabolic risk, she noted. The dietitian advised that staying around 1.2 gig per day of quality protein is safe and effective for most healthy adults, but your needs may vary based on lab results, medical history, and activity goals. It is best to consult a registered dietitian who can evaluate you personally and provide tailored guidance, especially if you have heart, kidney, or liver disease. From brain health to diabetes, three reasons to get your vitamin D levels checked. Source: Medical News. Vitamin D, also known as the sunshine vitamin, is often touted as a cure-all, but does its hype live up to the evidence? Past research has shown that vitamin D, which in the technical sense is actually a hormone or a prohormone, can benefit health in multiple ways, most notably bone and dental health, the immune system, and cardiovascular health. However, very high doses of vitamin D have also been linked to health risks such as nausea, vomiting, and weakness, which underscores the importance of seeking medical supervision before taking such supplements. Medical News Today has compiled three of the latest pieces of research investigating the benefits of vitamin D and summarizing their key findings. Published in the journal JAMA Network Open in April 2026, this study highlighted how vitamin D supplements can affect health outcomes depending on an individual's genetics. The researchers found that high-dose vitamin D supplementation reduced the risk of type 2 diabetes for some people, but had no significant effect on others, particularly people with the AC or CC variants of the vitamin D receptor gene had a 19% decrease in their risk of prediabetes developing into type 2 diabetes when taking 4,000 IU a day. However, the researchers and medical experts, Medical News Today, spoke to underscore the dangers of taking too much vitamin D, while reiterating that these findings would need to be replicated in larger trials. Diabetes is also a complex condition, where nutrition, genetics, exercise, weight, sleep, and many factors play a role in its development and progression, so a supplement alone is likely to do little in terms of prevention. This study adds to growing evidence that healthcare is evolving towards individual solutions and precision medicine. Through genetic testing, it is not a widespread practice and remains costly. This study makes a case for identifying patients who will benefit the most from a preventative solution or treatment. It's promising, and my reaction is cautious optimism. The study suggests that vitamin D administration in high-risk individuals with certain genetic types may be beneficial in preventing diabetes. It shows that in the future, we may be doing genetic testing to help determine if certain therapies can be used. Jennifer Chang, DO, Chief of Endocrinology at Hackensack Meridian Jersey Shore University Medical Center in New Jersey, who wasn't involved in this study, told MNT. Published in Neurology Open Access, an official journal of the American Academy of Neurology, study found that higher vitamin D levels were associated with lower tau protein levels, a key biomarker for Alzheimer's disease years later. Researchers from the University of Galway found that people with higher vitamin D levels in early middle age had lower tau protein levels on the brain scans conducted on an average 16 years later. However, they found no link between beta-amyloid, another major biomarker for Alzheimer's, and vitamin D levels in the blood. This study serves as a reminder that modifiable risk factors are crucial in preventing or slowing down disease progression in Alzheimer's and related dementias. If vitamin D deficiency can be addressed and treated earlier, the researchers hypothesize that this could reduce further future dementia risk. However, the study sample was small, homogeneous. Participants had their vitamin D levels checked only once at the beginning of the study, and many other factors such as lifestyle may have affected the outcomes. Stephen Alder, MD, a consultant neurologist at Recognition Health in London, the United Kingdom, who was not involved with the study, explained to MNT. Higher vitamin D levels may simply be a marker of overall better health rather than the driver of reduced tau pathology. For example, individuals with higher vitamin D are often more physically active, spend more time outdoors, and may have healthier diets, all of which are independently linked to better brain health. Published in the journal Cell Reports Medicine, this study suggests vitamin D supplements may benefit those with inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, by helping reset the gut's immune system. Researchers monitored 48 adults with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, both which fall under the umbrella of IBD, for 12 weeks and found that vitamin D helped reduce gut inflammation while promoting a more balanced immune response. Vitamin D increased levels of the antibodies IgA and decreased levels of IgG, which help the body recognize good gut bacteria while simultaneously preventing it from launching unnecessary attacks, as is what happens with an overactive immune system. Although exploratory due to its scale and scope, this study could help change how we approach the treatment of inflammatory bowel disease, adding to the evidence that vitamin D could be an adjunct therapy. In contrast, traditional treatments, which are best on suppressing the immune system, this study promotes immune tolerance, restraining the gut and immune system to coexist peacefully with gut bacteria. John Mark Gubitan, MD, study author and gastroenterologist at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, explained to MNT, "Our exploratory study highlights that there could be potential benefits with vitamin D in controlling the interactions between immune system, gut microbiome, in patients with IBD, and that further work is needed to understand the exact vitamin D levels and vitamin D supplements strategies to support this in patients with IBD and other chronic inflammatory disease." Daily multivitamin delays biological aging by up to 5 months, trial finds. Source: Medical News. Over the last few years, researchers have been focusing on finding new ways for people to slow their biological aging, the process by which the body begins to age, which may not match a person's chronological age. Living longer is one thing. Living better is just as important. Howard Cecio, SCD, MPH, Associate Director of Division of Preventative Medicine in the Mass General Brigham Department of Medicine, told Medical News Today. More clinical trials are needed under the effects of lifestyle and pharmacological interventions on biological aging captured through epigenetics and other biomarkers. Cecio is a senior author of a new study published in recently published in Nature Medicine that found taking a daily multivitamin may help slow biological aging, including in older adults already experiencing accelerated biological aging. COSMOS represented the first large-scale randomized clinical trial that examines the effects of a common dietary supplement on an epigenetic clock. "We hope to delve further into this COSMOS," Cecio explained. "We previously reported benefits in the COSMOS trial for the benefit of the multivitamin interaction on cognition and the cocoa extract intervention on cardiovascular disease death. So we leveraged the longitudinal biospecimen collected in a large subset of COSMOS participants to determine whether these benefits extended improvements in biological aging versus placebo." For this study, Cecio said they used a standard Centrum Silver multivitamin formulation at the time of the COSMOS trial and began in the mid-2010s, which is sold in the United States. It contains all essential vitamins and minerals at lower amounts, along with a few other nutrients, he explained. Whether the Cosmos trial findings extended to similar broad-based multivitamin formulas is an important question. Intuitively, it may, but we simply don't have the data to address it directly. Study participants were randomly selected to take either a multivitamin, cocoa extract, and a placebo, a multivitamin and placebo, or just placebos over 2 years. The multivitamin contained vitamins A, C, D3, E, and K, as well as B vitamins and minerals such as magnesium, zinc, calcium, and others. At the study's conclusion, researchers have found that participants in the multivitamin group had slowed 2 of the 5 epigenetic clocks compared with the placebo group. This translates to about 2.7 to 5.1 months of slowing after 2 years. Two specific second-generation epigenetic clock that the multivitamin slowed were the PC Grimage and the PC Phenoage, while the other three, which the multivitamin had no significant effect on, were the Horvath and the Hahnemann clocks, or the Dunedin pace measure. This finding, as part of a long-term, large-scale, randomized clinical trial, supports multivitamin use to improve biological aging in older adults, men aged 60 years and older, and women aged 65 years and older, Howard Sessio, SCD, MPH. Keep in mind that on average, biological aging through these clocks increased in both intervention groups, but the changes over 2 years were significantly less in the multivitamin group, he added. Additionally, scientists reported that participants who were biologically older than their actual age at the start of the COSMOS trial benefited the most from taking daily multivitamins. We were intrigued by this finding, which indicates that older participants who initially presented with greater biological aging versus their chronological actual age at baseline benefited more. It suggests that identifying those with more accelerated biological aging, chronic conditions, or poor diet, there would be greater improvement in biological aging through these epigenetic clocks among those taking a simple daily multivitamin compared with a placebo. Howard Sessio, SCD, MPH. We plan to delve more deeply into the epigenetic clocks from our DNA methylation data in COSMOS, plus have additional epigenetic data in 2 other large randomized clinical trials testing dietary supplements, Sessio said, when asked about the next planned steps for his research. More clinical trials are needed to understand the effects of lifestyle and pharmacologic interventions on biological aging captured through epigenetics and other biomarkers, he said. MNT spoke with Zisan Khan, MD, Chief of Geriatric Medicine at Hackensack Meridian Jersey Shore University Medical Center in New Jersey, about this study, who commented that his first reaction to its finding was a bit of a relief mixed with cautious optimism, as for years patients have asked him if they should be taking a multivitamin. Before this article, the evidence has been somewhat ambiguous for general well-nourished adults, Khan explained. Now we have a higher quality study which has found a safe, accessible, and affordable intervention that may slow down a key epigenetic aging clock. My optimism is cautious because we're still in the early stages of research in this complex field. We don't yet know if slowing an epigenetic aging clock will definitively translate to a longer, healthier life. However, this study gives me a concrete and evidence-based point of discussion for patients who are proactive about their health and worrying about their aging. Zisan Khan, MD. Khan said, while this study is a great first step, to translate this into a firm clinical recommendation, several things need to happen. First, we need long-term follow-up on clinical outcomes. Do those patients with a slowed-down epigenetic clock actually experience fewer age-related diseases? Think heart attack, cancer, or dementia, he detailed. Next, what was the mechanism of action? What is it, a specific vitamin or mineral in the supplement? Future studies could test different formulations to pinpoint the key ingredients and help us understand why it works. Finally, I would like to see the results replicated in a diverse population and see how well the intervention compares with other known interventions, such as the Mediterranean diet, Khan said. This would help us build a comprehensive, evidence-based toolkit to promote healthy aging. MNT also spoke with Monique Richard, MS, RDN, LDN, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and owner of Nutrition Insight for her tips on how readers can find a daily multivitamin to help them potentially slow their biological aging. Or, for those who prefer not to take a multivitamin, how can readers get those same vitamins in their diet, hopefully with the same benefit? I encourage clients to think food first, supplements second as necessary, Richard said. Multivitamins can help fill nutrient gaps, but they cannot replicate the complex matrix of nutrients, fiber, bioactive components found in whole foods that support healthy aging. When selecting a multivitamin or any supplement, Richard said to look for quality and transparency. Choose brands that are third-party tested, USP, NFS, or Consumer Lab, to verify quality, high standard of ingredients, and purity, what is described to be inside that is actually inside, she detailed. Avoid common marketing red flags, including vitamins and minerals in megadoses, i.e., 500% of the recommended daily allowance, unsubstantial health claims, and celebrity-type endorsements. Richard said the supplement should also match the stage of life. Products formulated for older adults may include certain nutrients needed at higher levels, such as vitamin B12, vitamin D, and calcium, which can become more difficult to absorb with age, whereas a child will have an entirely different need, as will athletes, and so on. Richards also reminded readers that many of the vitamins found in multivitamins can be obtained through dietary patterns associated with longevity, such as B vitamins, leafy greens, legumes, whole grains, vitamin C, citrus, berry, peppers, vitamin D, fatty fish, fortified dairy, juice, plant milks, eradicated mushrooms, vitamin E, nuts, seeds, wheat germ, vegetables, and fruits, magnesium, beans, nuts, legumes, vegetables, various antioxidant compounds found in plants such as berries, colorful vegetables, herbs, and spices. Healthy aging starts with what is on your plate, from what you purchase in the grocery store, at the farmer's market, or harvested from the land, not from a bottle or in the supplement aisle, Richard advised. Prioritizing investing your dollars on colorful produce and a good pair of walking shoes, and then on appropriate supplements as needed and recommended by the RDN and or your healthcare team. Type 1 diabetes linked to significantly higher dementia risk. Large U.S. study finds. Source: Medical News. Diabetes describes a group of metabolic conditions that typically result from problems with insulin production, action, or both. Thus, it is not uncommon for those living with diabetes to experience comorbid conditions or multimorbidity. This refers to an individual living with two or more chronic, long-term health conditions. Although the link between diabetes and dementia is not well understood, research has noted that diabetes can reduce dementia risk. Previous research has focused mostly on type 2 diabetes and its association with dementia. However, growing evidence is also highlighting a link between type 1 diabetes and dementia. Now, a new large cohort study published in Neurology suggests that people with type 2 diabetes have an elevated risk of dementia, but the risk may be even greater among those with type 2 diabetes. This highlights the need to better understand the mechanisms connecting diabetes and cognitive decline. However, the researchers caution that findings show an association rather than a cause and effect relationship. The large cohort study analyzed from the All of Us research program. This is a nationwide U.S. research initiative that links electronic health records with survey data to investigate long-term health outcomes. Researchers examined whether different forms of diabetes were associated with the development of dementia in adults aged 50 years and older. Among 283,772 participants included in the analysis, researchers identified 5,442 people with type 1 diabetes and 51,511 with type 2 diabetes. The participants had an average age of 64 years and were followed for an average of 2.4 years. During the study period, 2,348 people developed dementia. This included 144 of the participants with type 1 diabetes, 2.6%, 942 of those with type 2 diabetes, 1.8%, and the 1,262 of the 226,819 participants without disease, 0.6%. After adjusting factors such as age, sex, race, ethnicity, and education, the researchers estimated that people with type 1 diabetes were nearly three times as likely to develop dementia as those without. People with type 2 diabetes were about twice as likely to develop dementia compared with people without diabetes. Even after adjusting for lifestyle factors, such as smoking and alcohol use, the association remained strong. Participants with type 1 diabetes still had more than twice the risk of dementia relative to those without diabetes. Study author Annie Pedersen, MPH, research fellow at the Boston University of School of Public Health, was surprised at the magnitude of the association. As life expectancy among people with type 1 diabetes continues to increase, this elevated risk of dementia highlights the importance of understanding the neurological challenges this population may face with aging and underscores the need for greater awareness, monitoring, and targeted preventative strategies. The researchers also found that increased dementia risk linked to diabetes appeared broadly consistent across demographic groups. When researchers analyzed the data by sex, type 1 diabetes was associated with higher dementia risk in both females and males. Women with type 1 diabetes had slightly higher relative risk than men, though both groups showed stronger association. The elevated risk also appeared across racial and ethnic groups, including non-Hispanic white, Hispanic Latino, and other ethnic groups. Type 1 diabetes is far less common than type 2 diabetes, accounting for less than 5% of diabetes cases. However, these findings suggest that type 1 diabetes may play a significant role in dementia risk. Researchers estimated that about 64.5% of dementia cases among people with type 1 diabetes could be attributed to the condition itself. However, because type 1 diabetes is relatively rare in the general population, it accounted for roughly 3.9% of dementia cases overall in the study population. Health experts have long recognized diabetes as a risk factor for dementia, but most studies have focused on type 2 diabetes. The biological pathways linking diabetes to cognitive decline may differ between these two forms of diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is often associated with insulin resistance, chronic hyperglycemia, and metabolic complications that may damage blood vessels in the brain or promote protein buildup associated with Alzheimer's disease. Typically, people with type 1 diabetes require lifelong insulin therapy to manage the condition and may experience episodes of low blood sugar. The researchers propose that recurrent hypoglycemia, inflammation, oxidative stress, and long-term metabolic disruption may contribute to brain changes that increase dementia risk. Commenting on the possible biological mechanisms at play, Pedersen told Medical News Today, "Individuals with type 1 diabetes are typically diagnosed at a younger age, leading to longer disease duration across the life course, which may add up to higher dementia risk over time. In addition, while type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes may share some of the same pathways, type 1 diabetes is biologically distinct and may involve additional mechanisms that should be further studied. While there may be growing interest in whether long-term patterns of blood glucose and episodes of hypoglycemia could play a role in dementia etiology, our study was not designed to examine these mechanisms directly. and more research is needed to better understand how these factors may contribute to dementia risk in people with type 1 diabetes, Peterson added. A key aspect of the study was the development of a new algorithm to distinguish between type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes using electronic health records. Diagnostic codes can overlap, and some people with advanced type 2 diabetes may also require insulin. This can make accurate identification of diabetes subtypes in large databases challenging. To address this, the researchers created a classification method based on the number of clinical encounters coded as type 1 diabetes. The approach was validated against two reference standards, self-reported diabetes type and laboratory measures of the C-peptide, a marker of pancreatic insulin production. This method enabled the researchers to analyze dementia risk separately for each diabetes subtype in a very large population. The researchers noted that the study had several limitations. Diagnosis of both diabetes and dementia were identified using electronic health records and survey data, which may not capture every case. People with type 1 diabetes may also interact with healthcare system more frequently, potentially increasing the likelihood that dementia is identified earlier. Additionally, because of the All of Us cohort is not nationally represented and relies partly on convenient sampling through the healthcare systems, the findings may not fully generalize to the broader U.S. population. As a result, the findings should be interpreted cautiously. The study shows a link between diabetes and dementia, but does not prove that the diabetes directly causes the dementia. Further research will be necessary to better understand the biological mechanism that may connect diabetes to cognitive decline and to identify strategies that could reduce the risk. While all findings help clarify the association between type 1 diabetes and dementia risk, important questions remain, Peterson noted. To understand the elevated risk among those with type 2 diabetes, future research should examine the role of co-occurring clinical conditions and other potential modifiable risk factors that may help identify subgroups at higher risk, she added. In addition, studies are needed to better understand the biological mechanism underlying this association and to determine whether targeted prevention and management strategies can reduce dementia risk in individuals with type 1 diabetes. Together, this could inform more personalized approaches to care and prevention, Peterson told us. Despite these limitations, the researchers say findings add important evidence that diabetes subtype matters when assessing dementia risk. A life expectancy for people with type 1 diabetes continues to improve. More individuals with condition are reaching older age, which is the strongest known risk factor for dementia. As such, the results of this study may indicate more regular cognitive screening for those living with type 1 diabetes. These findings highlight the need for greater awareness of dementia risk in patients with type 1 diabetes, Peterson added. For clinicians, this may mean considering cognitive health as part of a long-term diabetes care, particularly as people with type 1 diabetes are living longer, she said. For individuals with type 1 diabetes, the results suggest increased but not certainty of developing dementia and reinforce the importance of ongoing care, monitoring, and management of overall health as they age. Annie Peterson, MPH. We should be clear, however, that the findings from our study and other studies should press us to better understand how to help delay or prevent the development of dementia in people living with type 1 diabetes, Peterson added. Currently, health experts advise the following strategies to help reduce the dementia risk: manage blood sugar levels, control high blood pressure, maintain a healthy weight, eat a healthy diet, keep physically active, stay mentally active, stay connected with family and friends, treat hearing problems, take care of mental and physical health, sleep well, prevent head injuries, drink less alcohol, stop alcohol use. Common anti-seizure drug may help prevent Alzheimer's plaque. Source Medical News. A new paper published in Science Translational Medicine investigated whether levetiracetam, or Keppra, an anti-seizure medication, could form the basis of innovative drug treatments for Alzheimer's disease. The researchers' three-prong investigation showed that Keppra prevents the buildup of faulty amyloid beta proteins in an animal model. They also found that when given to mice engineered to develop the amyloid buildup, fewer synapses were disrupted. While there's a long road ahead involving much more research before than the drug can be repurposed for patients, the authors are optimistic about the mechanism. With the number of people with Alzheimer's in the United States predicted to rise to 14 million by 2060, and with no effective medications yet available, this work is likely to be followed up on. When one nerve sends a signal to another, it must do so by crossing the gap between, called a synapse. Once the electrical signal reaches the end of the first neuron, the presynapse terminal, neurotransmitters are released that travel across the synapse in membrane-bound bubbles called synaptic vesicles. Once these vesicles reach the second neuron, postsynaptic terminal, they activate the receptors and the electrical signal continues. Keppra appears to work by binding receptors on synaptic vessels at the presynaptical terminal, influencing the most of the neurotransmitter release. This helps calm the overactive neurons responsible for seizures. How does that relate to Alzheimer's? Research suggests that presynaptic regions are important in the formation of the amyloid beta, a protein associated with Alzheimer's disease. For this reason, there's been a fair amount of research into Keppra and its potential to improve mild cognitive impairment, MCI, and Alzheimer's disease. Existing studies have produced some promising results, and overall, the drug does seem to improve cognitive function in people with MCI and Alzheimer's. According to the authors, the precise mechanism by which Keppra reduces amyloid buildup is unclear, so their study digs into the mechanisms by which Keppra might work. Other drugs designed to address protein buildups associated with Alzheimer's can successfully clear proteins that have already accumulated, but they do not provide much benefit for patients. The authors hope that by preventing the accumulation rather than clearing the existing accumulation, Keppra-based drugs might make more of a difference to disease progression. Scientists already understood that amyloid precursor protein, APP, is part of the issue in the development of the Alzheimer's disease. If it's proceeded incorrectly, it creates faulty, misfolded forms of beta amyloid. What the new study adds to this discovery is the way in which the APP is transported into also determines whether a neuron forms misfolded protein. As we explain, vesicles travel between the presynaptic and postsynaptic neurons. As part of this process, synaptic vesicles are recycled at the neuron cell left surface so they can be reused. The scientists found that Keppra slows this recycling, keeping APP at the cell surface for longer, preventing it from heading down the chemical biopathway to become misfolded and toxic. In our 30s, 40s, and 50s, our brains are generally able to steer proteins away from harmful pathways, explained corresponding author Jeffrey Savas, associate professor of behavioral neurological at Northwestern University, Feinberg of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. As we age, the brain's protective ability gradually weakens. This is not a statement of disease. This is just part of aging. But in brains developing Alzheimer's, too many neurons go astray, and that's when you get the amyloid beta production, and then it's tau, or tangles, and then it's dead cells, then dementia, then neuroinflammation, and then it's too late, Jeffrey Savas, corresponding author. Medical News Today reached out to Dr. Christina Nye, a psychiatrist and interventional psychiatrist, medically director of the MindPath Health, who was not involved in the study. A key advance in the reframing of Alzheimer's as an early presynaptic disorder, this paradigm shift reinforces Alzheimer's as an early presynaptic disorder, not a solely late-stage plaque-driven disease. This position, the synapse as a variable earlier therapeutic target, she concluded. Sadly, although the mechanism may help scientists design useful drugs for dementia, as it stands, it will not be the answer we are looking for. According to Savas, for the drug to work, you needed to take it very, very early. You need to take it long before there were any psychological or neurological signs. You could take this when you already have dementia. You couldn't take this when you already have dementia because the brain has already undergone a number of irreversible changes and a lot of cell death, he explains. So, for future work, Savas plans to look at populations with significantly elevated risk of Alzheimer's, like people with Down syndrome, these people could likely benefit. If you started giving these patients Keppra in their teenage years, it could actually have a preventative therapy benefit. Another issue is that the drug breaks down very quickly once it's in your body, so Savas and his colleagues are planning on designing similar drugs that persist longer. Alongside their mechanistic work, their researchers also look through existing data on the use of Keppra. Because it has been FDA approved for decades, there's ample research into its safety and efficacy. In particular, they investigated whether people with Alzheimer's who were prescribed Keppra experienced slower cognitive decline compared with people other than antiepileptics with a different mechanism of action. As they hoped, they found that the individuals taking Keppra had a longer duration between cognitive decline and death. In other words, disease progression seemed to slow. Although the magnitude of change was small, on a scale of a few years, says Savas, this analysis supports the positive effect of Keppra to slow the progression of Alzheimer's pathology. However, more work lies ahead, while clinical translation remains necessary, caution is warranted, explained Nye. These findings are largely preclinical. Sex-specific effects were observed, and the relevance to sporadic late-onset Alzheimer's remains to be fully established. Optimal dosing, timing of intervention, and a long-term cognitive outcome will require further clinical validation. Now a recipe from the Diabetes magazine, strawberries with honeyed yogurt sauce. 4 servings, about a quarter of a cup sauce, with about 1 cup strawberries, about 7 berries. Calories 88, fat 1 gram, saturated fat 1 gram, protein 4 grams, carbs 16 grams, cholesterol 4 milligrams, fiber 4 grams, sodium 41 milligram. Exchanges per serving, 1 fruit, half a cup of milk, 1 cup of plain yogurt, 1 tablespoon of orange juice, 1 to 2 teaspoons of honey ground cinnamon to taste, 1 quart of fresh strawberries, stems removed. In a small bowl, combine yogurt, orange juice, honey, and cinnamon to taste. Mix well. Divide strawberries among serving dishes. Spoon yogurt sauce evenly over strawberries and serve. That's all my time for today. Hope you enjoyed listening to Diabetes at the Talking Information Center.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Hummingbirds use their long tongues to sip nectar from flowers. They're able to roll their tongues into a tube-like shape. Since the 1800s, scientists thought those tongues worked through capillary action, like how water instantly rises into a straw in a full cup. This happens passively. The water is attracted to the surface, against gravity. But when scientists spent years using slow-motion cameras to capture hummingbirds drinking in greater detail, they uncovered a completely different story. The tongues aren't just passively drawing up nectar. They act like a tiny but powerful pump. Basically, hummingbirds use their tongues a bit like a bulb syringe or baster. First, the hummingbird flattens the tongue before putting it in the nectar. Then, once in contact with the liquid, the tongue expands, sucking the nectar inside. Finally, the hummingbird whips the tongue back to drink the mouthful. the whole process repeats many times per second. Actively pumping their nectar lets hummingbirds drink about 3 times faster than if they just used their tongues like straws. While it's a surprising adaptation, it's no surprise to find that the tongues of hummingbirds are just as busy as their bodies. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.